Speaking on this program is Franklin Kemp.
The book of Psalms. The book of Psalms fit in somewhere at some period in relationship to the nation of Israel, other than the Psalms that were written by Moses, and of course he was the leader of the nation. In order to appreciate the Psalms, you need to have a good knowledge of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And in addition to that, you need to know something about the prophets, because the prophets prophesied during this period of time, so that you can appreciate more the prophets and the Psalms when you read and study them. We've been studying, studied Sunday morning, last Sunday morning, Psalms 1, which sets the stage for all there is in the Psalms. If you want to be able to breathe the spirit of the Psalms, to express the attitude that's in the Psalms, how the sense of dependence that's set forth in the Psalms, be able to be thankful to God and grateful for His redemption is set forth in the Psalms, be able to pray as they prayed in the Psalms, then Psalms 1 sets the stage for it. There's the blessed man. But then as you see the trials and the difficulties that are set forth in the Psalms, it's important to see the second Psalm. For here you have the opposition to people that are righteous, the opposition to God's will. Verse 1 of chapter 2 said, "Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth have set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords." Now look at verse 4. "He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, and the Lord shall have them in derision." And so you see, in spite of all the opposition of man, God still rules. And that passage says that God will laugh at them and have them in derision when they think that they can overthrow and defeat the purpose of God. That's encouraging to people that want to do right. That's encouraging to people that are having difficult and trying times, to know that God's purpose cannot be overthrown. And as long as my life is in keeping with God's purpose, things will be well. Now it's in view of that Psalms 3 and 4 were written by David. Let me again review the fact that in 2 Samuel 15 through 18, Absalom has undermined the people of the nation of Israel in their attitude toward David. The record says that he stole their hearts through deceit and telling them that they needed somebody that had taken interest in them. And so the people then were going to follow Absalom through his deceit and getting people behind him. And David had to leave the throne and leave Jerusalem and running for his life. Psalm 3 is a morning prayer, likely prayed after the first night that he had been running from Jerusalem and running from Absalom. Some few days have passed, some time at least, and we come to Psalms 4, which is an evening prayer. And as I said this morning, I'd like to encourage you to think about Psalms 3 as you begin the day. Let it be your morning prayer. And then as we come to the close of the day, Psalms 4 is a good prayer, a psalm to read and study. And let the sentiment of this prayer control our minds and our hearts as we close the day. Listen as to how he begins. Remember the problems that he had? He's off of the throne. He hadn't received it back. And yet there's confidence and a sense of need in what he said. Verse 1, "Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness." Two things in that. Number one, David knows that God is just. He knows that God will do that which is right. You recall when Abraham was praying for Lot in Sodom, and in Genesis 18, Abraham said, "Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" And therefore, God's justice will prevail. Just as surely as God is on the throne and that people do that which is wrong, God's justice will see that they're not going to be successful. David knew that the attempt of Absalom and those who were following him to try to take the throne was not in keeping with God's will, and God's justice would take care of that. But then note the rest of the verse. "Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress." Do you ever feel like you're just pinned in and you don't have anywhere to go? Does life ever feel like it's just hemmed up and we just don't have breathing space? And do you ever get in a place sometimes where it just seems like you're smothered? I was down here yesterday morning while David and Joy and Grady was helping. Grady stayed on the outside like I did. But David and Joy crawled all the way up that duct, tore out the insulation that was blocking where it had fallen down, was blocking the airflow. And I just thought about it. No way could I crawl up there. I'd smother to death. Just the idea of being in there would smother me. And I just couldn't think about it. And so, when you think about David's situation, you remember earlier there had been the time when David was running from Saul. And David was on one side of the mountain and Saul was on the other. Saul was right on his heels. And it seemed as though David was just hemmed in and there was nowhere to go. You remember the story, though, how that God, just as David said, "God hath enlarged me." He opened up the way when I was hemmed in and had nowhere to go. That's the way it was when David was running. That's what it seemed like. But based on past experience, David said, "I remember before when I've been in some tight places, and how thou hast enlarged me. And therefore the plea, have mercy upon me and hear my prayer." If you find yourself in a tight spot and feel like you're hemmed in, and it seemed like that things are just closing in on you, remember this prayer. Remember David's situation. And let him remind you of what can happen. Can you look back over your life and think about times when it seemed like there just wasn't any way to turn or anywhere to go? That things were just closing in and there wasn't going to be any way out. And yet there was a way. God enlarged it, opened up the way. I can look back in life and see times when I wondered, how in the world would this ever come out? How in the world would I ever make it through it? But I have learned that, just as David said, that God enlarged me, opened up the way. And when I thought I was hemmed in, that was not true. And when you find yourself in a situation like that, do like David did. Learn to say, "Have mercy upon me, O God, and hear my prayer." Then note verse 2. Verse 2 is an exhortation directed toward those who are in rebellion against God and in rebellion against David. And so he said, "O ye sons of men, how long will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love vanity and seek after leasing," or lying, or falsehood? And so David is directing his thought toward them, and there may have been some that had gone with David who wondered, how in the world are we going to ever be able to be successful when Absalom already has the throne, he has David's counselor, Ahithophel, and he has the majority of the people on his side? Where is there any way out? And so David said, "Listen, do you think you can take my throne away from me that God gave? Do you think you can do that and be successful? How long will you love vanity?" That is emptiness. That's what the word vanity means. See, and it was through falsehood that Absalom had been able to obtain the throne. And therefore, through falsehood and deceit, David had been driven from it. David said, let me tell you something. The path you're following is one that's empty. It's not going to be successful. And when you use falsehood to try to succeed, you can be sure you're going to end up in defeat. Then again in verse 3, look at it. When you find yourself situated like David, how do you react? Look at the very first two words of verse 3. But no. What? But no. How can one have assurance in circumstances like that? Isn't that wonderful to know that when life seems to be closing in and the doors are closing round about us, that we can know some things? But know that the Lord has set apart him that is godly for himself. It was God that had set apart David as king. And God had set him apart for himself to be used by God. Therefore, he belonged to God. And that's true of Christians. We are set apart and we belong to God. Let us remember that when we find ourselves in difficult situations. To remember that I belong to God, that I've been set apart for God. But now, when I've been set apart for God, then what about it? Listen to what he said. The Lord will hear me when I call upon him. David said, God has set me apart. He made me king. Therefore, when I call on God, he'll hear. There's a promise that God's made to Christians. God has promised to hear our prayer. Do I realize that and appreciate that when I find myself in difficult circumstances? Place yourself where David was. How would you have prayed, or would you have prayed? Place yourself in David's circumstances, and would you have thought, if I have been set apart by God, then why am I in a situation like this? But I thought like that. David didn't. He understood some things about life. He understood some things about God and God's will. And therefore, knowing that, there were some things that he was sure of. And so we ought to be certain about some things. The fact that they had driven him from Jerusalem and from his throne didn't mean that God didn't still live and that God didn't still rule and that God's will would not be accomplished. Then look at verse 4. A further exhortation to the ones that had driven him off, and no doubt included himself as he thought about it. Stand in awe and sin not. Now, if we think about this being directed toward the ones that had been guilty of sin and rebelling against God, then you can see the significance of it. David said, stop and think about what you're doing. Stand in awe of God. Stand in reverence before God. And that's important for all of us. You see how that would change our outlook on life? If in the midst of situations I'd stop and realize that I'm in the presence of God and stand there in awe. But not only that, listen. Sin not. If Absalom and the ones that had driven David from the throne had done this, they would have thrown down their arms. And that had been the end of it. But they didn't do that. Then further he says, commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. That is, stop. Think. Listen. Examine your own heart in the stillness of the night. And ask the question, what's going on? What am I doing? And in doing that, we'll find some answers to some of our problems. And where things are wrong, if we'd been like the ones that had rebelled against God, think about what would happen. Think about what would happen to those that have ceased to serve God today. If tonight, in the quietness of their own home and apart from the things of the world, they had stopped and realized that they're in the presence of God, that shut the world out and be alone with God. Commune with our own hearts. And in the stillness of that, there'd be some changes made. And that's what David said. He knew that things would change, they'd do that. But in view of his own situation, he knew also the application to make to his own life. Then look at verse 5. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. You remember, when I read from 2 Samuel 15 through 17, how that Absalom went to David and he said, while I was away from home, I made a vow to God, and I want to go and fulfill that vow and offer some sacrifices. All of that was in pure hypocrisy. He wanted to use, and did use that as an opportunity to stir up men and to get men to follow him in rebellion against David. That's hypocrisy. And therefore, David is saying, offer the sacrifices of righteousness. And that's what Absalom needed to do. That's what those who were following him needed to do. And perhaps there were those with David who wondered, how will the outcome be? And if this was made to the ones that was with David, then he said, trust for and put your trust in the Lord. You remember how that Absalom had placed his trust and he hit the fell? And it didn't work out. And therefore, the significance of that verse. Then look at verse 6. There be many that say, who will show us any good? Have you ever been like that? What good will it do? What good can come from it? How can anything come out of this that'll be worthwhile? And that's what people often say about people that are living and serving God. No good can ever come from it. But look at what David said. Lord, lift up the light of thy countenance upon me. And we're back now to Numbers 6, the last verse of that chapter, which I read this morning. And David knew that if that was done, that the blessings pronounced through Aaron, as announced by God in Numbers 6, as Moses commanded Aaron to say that, then the light of God's countenance would be upon him and he'd be blessed. Peter said that the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous. That is, there's the light of his countenance that sees. The eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open to their cries, or their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against, turned away from, and the light of his countenance is not toward them. And David knew that in this rebellion that was taking place, that God's face was opposed to and turned from the ones that was in the rebellion. And therefore he knew they're not going to succeed. And look at verse 7. Think about the occasion. Thou hast put gladness in my heart more than in the time that their corn and their wine increased. You remember how Barzillai came to him and he brought provision because they didn't have anything. The material things of life were limited. But David said, there's gladness in my heart. They don't know anything about. I think it's unfortunate that we have come to think that gladness and joy is related to circumstances, situations in life. That's not true. Because if our happiness and our joy depends upon material things and upon circumstances that surrounds us, our joy and our happiness will be up and down here and there. It'll be temporary. You'll find in studying the Bible that people that were godly and people that understood what religion is all about realized that joy and gladness is based upon what's inward and in one's relationship to God. And that when that's true, no circumstance in life can take away the gladness and the joy that is there. Paul could write an epistle of joy from a Roman prison cell. Rejoice. And again I say rejoice. Writing to the Philippians. And that was written from the prison cell in Rome. Why? How could he rejoice in circumstances like that? You remember in Acts 16 when he was in the jail at Philippi? How that at midnight Paul and Silas were singing and praying? Their backs were bleeding. But there was gladness on the inside that no one could take away from them. When our life then is measured by things and by situations, whatever joy we have will be limited. It'll be up and down. How could David, in view of all that was taking place, say, "Thou hast put gladness in my heart"? You know, when you have a bountiful harvest, how wonderful it is. Think about all the good gardens you had this year. Just blessed. Our deep freeze is running over because you've been blessed with harvest and you've blessed us. But what is that in comparison with the joys that are inward and that the world doesn't know anything about? And the sad thing about it is too many of us don't know anything about it. We don't know what that real joy is. As you think about life from day to day, does that arise within your heart a sense of joy in knowing that God is mine and I belong to God? Does that come to your soul a thrill because you know that? Or does it mean anything to you? David said, even in a situation like this, there's a gladness and a joy that I have. It's better than a harvest. Now then, with that attitude, the day's come to an end. How is he going to end the day? Listen, the last verse. I'll both lay me down in peace. How? Running from David, or rather running from Absalom, we've already read in Psalms 3, in the morning, he said, I slept good last night. But now then, he's getting ready for another night's sleep. The throne's not his anymore. But he said, I will both lay me down in peace and sleep. What a blessing. To be able to lay down in peace and sleep in circumstances like that. Don't you cherish that? Wouldn't you like to have that? Where can there be anything that can equal that? What does the world have to offer that can match that? It's not there. How many people in the world tonight would give all that they have for that? But money can't buy it. It's not to be had that way. Do you see the value of this song? To be able to say that I'll both lay me down in peace and sleep. And there's a reason. For thou, Lord, only makest me to dwell in safety. The word "only" there, as it reads in the King James translation, is a little bit misleading. The margin of the American Standard Version has the word "solitude." And so David said, even in the trial that he is now going through, "When I come to the end of the day, I'll lay me down in peace and sleep, for Thou, Lord, hast placed me in solitude." One translation says in isolation. What a promise. To come to the end of the day with the stresses and the strains of life, whatever they may have been, and with the sentiment of this song, to say, "I'm going to lay down in peace and sleep. For God grants me solitude." Isolated from the strain and the stress of the world, as though His arms were round about me and His blessings are mine. Isn't that a wonderful way to close the day? Isn't that something to strive after, to look forward to? That's something that God has promised. And the Bible teaches us that may be ours. The sun is gone down in the west. The shades of night are gathering fast. We'll soon be on our way. And ere long, we'll be in bed. When that time comes, can I lay down in peace and sleep, conscious of the fact that God has placed me in solitude, in isolation? And in His solitude, there has been built a wall of protection and quietness and stillness that grasps the heart. And in spite of what the day may have brought in the stress and the strain, there comes a resounding sound because of that. The echoing voice that says, "All is well." That's worth living for. That's worth having. And that's what Christianity means. Let me encourage you to read Psalms 3 and Psalms 4. I hope in the morning before you begin your work, begin your day, you'll turn and read Psalms 3 and let the sentiment of that psalm direct you through the day. And let your life be such in the will of God and dedicated to His service and to His glory. And when you come to the end of the day tomorrow, whatever the world may have thrown at you, whatever may have been the stresses and the strains of life, ere you go to sleep tomorrow night, you'll read Psalms 4. And as you close your eyes in peaceful sleep, let your imagination visualize the arms of God. As it were, He takes you and holds you in solitude and isolated from the strains and the stress and the things of life that hurt. Wouldn't you like to be a Christian? Wouldn't you like to have that? That's for you and for me, provided I want it. And I'll dedicate my life to living for Him as David did in His service. Live for His honor and His glory, the realization that God reigns on high and His purpose will succeed. My friend, you can't oppose God and win, but you can bow to His will and have the promises that He's made. Do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Are you penitent of your sins? Will you confess Him tonight and be baptized for the remission of your sins? If you haven't been living as you should, and you know your life hasn't been for His honor and His glory. You've been negligent and careless and brought shame and reproach upon His name. You couldn't read Psalms 4 tonight and go to bed. All you could do would do as verse 4 said, stand in awe and commune with your own heart and the realization that you need to examine your life and straighten things out. Go home tonight and read Psalms 4 and let that psalm be yours.